evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, August 4th, 2016. The United Nations Human Rights Commission says there is clear evidence that the South Sudan Army committed crimes against civilians during last month's fighting in Juba.
There's a decision to set up a hybrid court, but that's being very slow to get off the ground. That could help. That's a model that's worked in some other countries where the local system's too weak to cope with the crimes that are being committed.
And civil society groups are calling on South Sudanese leaders to end the renewed fighting in South Sudan.
What we need to do is that if you're having a problem, you must negotiate with the government, dialogue with the government, and I believe you will get a solution. The government of national unity must champion dialogues and negotiation with those who took arms against the state.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The office of the UN Human Rights Commission is calling on the UN Security Council and African Union to pressure South Sudan government officials into ending cycle of violence against innocent civilians. A preliminary investigation by the UN's Human Rights Office says hundreds of civilians have been killed and hundreds of cases of sexual violence reported during and after the fighting that began last month. Ayen Bior has more from Washington.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights says they have documented at least 217 cases of sexual violence in the capital, Juba, between July 8th and July 25th. Women from various ethnic groups were targeted and raped by armed youth believed to be affiliated to the SPLA in opposition. But for the most part, the UN report says, the perpetrators were government soldiers. Rupert Colville, a Geneva-based spokesperson for OHCHR, says UN investigators documented at least 73 civilian deaths, but a more accurate figure could be in the hundreds. Colville says investigators also expect the number of rape cases to rise.
Yes, unfortunately, very probably are more cases. Very often women who have been through this kind of experience don't report it. So the fact that we've already documented at least 217 cases gives you an idea of the scale of what was going on.
The international human rights community, including Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, had already documented widespread and systematic violence committed by South Sudanese government soldiers against civilians throughout the country since the conflict erupted in late 2013. A report released in March by the UN Human Rights Office says both government and opposition forces have carried out thousands of brutal rapes and gang rapes since 2013 as a weapon of war. Colville says in large part, rapes, killings, and crimes against civilians in South Sudan continue because of widespread impunity. He says victims told the UN that government soldiers would take groups of women at a time, hold them against their will, and rape them.
A lot of checkpoints were set up over the city while the fighting was going on or after it broke out on the 7th of July. And these seemed to be the places where women were getting held and then raped.
Colville says government soldiers have made a habit out of committing violence against civilians because they know they won't be held accountable. He says the government is primarily responsible for arresting soldiers who commit crimes, but the UN needs to step up and hold government leaders accountable as well.
One call we're making today is to the Security Council, really to put pressure on the government in particular to start changing this cycle. Also the African Union. I mean, there's been, there's a decision to set up a hybrid court, but that's being very slow to get off the ground. That could help. That's a model that's worked in some other countries where the local system's too weak to cope with the crimes that are being committed.
Last week, military spokesman Luol Roy Kwong said the army detained 14 SPLA soldiers accused of killing civilians and looting property following last month's fighting. Kwong says the SPLA set up a court-martial to try the soldiers. But Colville says much more must be done to ensure that the culture of violence ends in South Sudan. The Transitional Government of National Unity, which was set up in late April, was supposed to pave the way for the creation of a hybrid court that would deliver justice to the victims of South Sudan's 32-month-long conflict. But since the fighting broke out in early July and President Kiir's decision to replace several SPLA-IO ministers and First Vice President Riek Machar, many question the legitimacy of the current government. Colville says the international community should not stand idly by. He says the Security Council and the African Union have a responsibility to see that justice is served to the thousands of innocent victims in South Sudan. For VOA News, I'm Ian Bior in Washington.
There has been mixed reaction to President Salva Kiir's decree this week, firing six ministers allied to former first Vice President Riek Machar and replacing them with members of SPLM-IO who backed Taban Deng Gai, the newly appointed first Vice President. The head of South Sudan Civil Society Alliance is urging stakeholders to the IGAD peace deal to focus not on the current political changes, but rather on how to silence the guns. Tito Justin has this report for VOA from Juba.
Civil Society Alliance Chief Akwach Ajang welcomes the move to appoint Taban Deng Gai as the country's first vice president and Mr. Kiir's decision to remove six ministers allied to former Vice President Machar. But Ajang advises Kiir's administration to meet with officials who oppose the recent changes in order to prevent further bloodshed. He also urges gunmen wreaking havoc across the country to present their demands to the government. Ajang says the IGAD broker deal is the only path forward for the country.
What we need to do is that if you have a problem, you must negotiate with the government, dialogue with the government, and I believe you will get a solution. That also applies to the government of national unity. The government of national unity must champion dialogues and negotiation with those who took arms against the state.
The acting head of South Sudanese Opposition Political Alliance, Peter Mayen, says he worries about the new changes in Juba. Mayen, who heads the People's Liberal Party, says the sacking of Machar and former ministers will negatively impact implementation of the peace agreement. He says President Kiir's decree violates the peace deal because Mr. Kiir did not consult partners of the Transitional Government of National Unity as required under the terms of the peace agreement.
The questions right now, which we all are looking to see, whether the new changes in Juba here will be able to ensure that a foundation is laid where democracy can be built on. As we speak now, there's a very little political space to voice out, and it seems that we are only heading to one-way political system.
Mayen is calling for reforms in the security sector and for a unified army as the way to end South Sudan's violence. Ajang says the country will never develop unless South Sudanese of different ethnic origins unite as brothers and sisters.
If we don't unite, if we don't coexist, this country will not progress. The country is in hard time that need harmony, that need peaceful coexistence, that need a responsibility. As a citizen, we have duties and rights. It is my duty as a citizen of this country to serve the nation by doing the right thing.
Both Ajang and Mayen are calling for an end to the violence and urging the country's leaders to start serving the interests of South Sudanese rather than their personal interests. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
The People's Republic of China's multi-billion dollar investment in South Sudan's oil infrastructure was meant to provide Beijing with yet another petroleum source and provide it with a place to showcase its influence. But political turmoil and civil war has prevented China from getting significant returns on its efforts for more than 2.5 years. And now the situation is getting worse. VOA's Jeffrey Yang reports.
South Sudan's political turmoil, heightened in recent days by President Salva Kiir's removal of his key rival, First Vice President Riek Machar, has bloodied the streets of the capital Juba and sent even more people fleeing to the safety of United Nations protection camps. Machar's removal and Kiir's replacement of him with their former mediator, Taban Deng Gai, followed Machar's sudden departure from Juba several weeks ago. That effectively collapsed the agreed-upon transitional government that began in April when Machar returned to the capital after fighting erupted in December 2013. That collapse has also impacted China's massive investment in the East African nation's oil sector, prompting the China National Petroleum Corporation, known as CNPC, to evacuate nearly 200 of its people. Because of the conflict, very little oil, now estimated at only 120,000 barrels a day, is presently going to market. One South Sudan first-hand observer describes the tattered oil infrastructure left in the wake of the country's convulsions. Via Skype, journalist Anthony Lowenstein.
Often the facilities don't exist anymore. They need to be rebuilt from the ground up. Who's going to invest in that? Who's going to spend money on that? At the moment, virtually nobody is.
China began investing in Sudan's oil fields before that nation's southern half broke with Khartoum and became independent in 2011. South Sudan's oil still goes through Sudan via pipeline, with Khartoum extracting a transit fee for its passage. China is also making an investment in South Sudan's peace and security. At least 700 Chinese troops are part of the United Nations mission in South Sudan, known by the acronym UNMISS. But these soldiers are not deployed to protect South Sudan's oil fields. They're sheltering civilians in UN-created safe zones. Beijing may be the most capable nation to exert influence in resolving Juba's shattered political structure, according to Center for Strategic and International Studies Africa Director Jennifer Cook.
They have, in some ways, more leverage than the United States and the international community, in that they kind of have the purse strings of oil production and oil exploration.
Oil revenue is the foundation of South Sudan's economy, and according to observers, has also been key to President Kiir's hold on power. Again, via Skype, Anthony Lowenstein.
Because it's a kleptocracy, the South Sudanese government used that oil revenue to pay off friends and allies to keep on their side. As that oil money has essentially disappeared and dried up, it's become incredibly difficult for South Sudan to remain intact.
Since China has such a large multi-billion-dollar investment in South Sudan's oil industry, one might think that Beijing would aggressively pursue a diplomatic solution to the country's political crisis. But Beijing's special representative on African affairs, Zhang Jinhua, who met with South Sudan's political leadership in early May, publicly maintains China's non-interventionist policy toward African states.
Well, I don't think we are the party to be correct to propose our own initiative, at least at this stage.
Meanwhile, the nation barely functions with its population often fed by NGOs and partially protected by a UN force trying to stay out of the crossfire between its heavily armed and angry factions. And observers say that's not likely to change in the foreseeable future. Jeffrey Young, VOA News.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at why some South Sudanese farmers have enough food, but at the same time, they are stuck. Find out why when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
What's your favorite traditional game?
I don't have any because me myself, I'm not the traditional game type. I hardly play.
I like Ludo. It's a board game where we play with the dice and some tokens. It's quite interesting.
I worry and draft largely because they are thought-provoking games. And whilst you're playing, you're calculating.
I like Pilolo because my mommy used to show me where they hide a stick, so I'm always first.
I think Moeso. Moeso is okay. Yeah, Ludo is okay. I like Ludo.
It's Owari. Owari is a game between two people. It bonds you together. You are able to score at certain point. Tells the truth. Because when you win, everybody knows that you have won.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Hundreds of farmers in Magui County of Imatong State have produced enough food this season. But widespread insecurity and looting along the roads leading in and out of the area is frustrating farmers who are trying to take their harvest to markets in Juba and Torit. Dimo Silva Aurelio has this report for VOA from Torit.
A majority of farmers in Magui use hand hoes to plow the land. A few farmers who have money hire an ox plow to till their first agricultural farms where maize is grown. Ochan Awata harvested a lot of maize this season, using both hand hoes and ox plow on his 30-hectare farm. But Awata says he is disappointed that for the past 3 weeks he has been unable to take his maize to market in the state capital, Torit, because of widespread insecurity on the Magui-Torit road.
This is the dry one. And the fresh one that I want to take to Juba is 5 hectares. And I also have another 5 hectares of maize crop that I am already weeding.
He says because of rampant insecurity on the roads, he was able to earn at least 50,000 South Sudanese pounds in a week.
Now, people are fearing to travel to Juba because the road also is bad. We work tirelessly for this food and we do not want to just lose it on the road. That is why our focus is mostly Juba, where we make good profit.
Ben Kingston, Magui County Commissioner, confirms that farmers here produce enough food this season to feed their families and sell more at the markets. He says county authorities and the Imotongi state government officials are working to restore security on the roads so farmers can provide food to markets in Juba and other parts of South Sudan.
Magui is harvesting now maize due to the incident happening in Juba and the spillover up. Magui has disrupted the usual movement of this produce. So most people prefer to take it deeper than to eat.
Kingston says local farmers usually sell all the produce of the first season every year when it is still fresh because they do not have equipment to preserve it.
The farmers prefer to sell all this fresh because of the issue of drying. You know, the rains are raining here daily.
The commissioner says despite insecurity on the roads, dozens of farmers in Magui still risk taking their produce to Juba where they think they can make a higher profit. Despite the abundant harvest in Magui County, famine is a big problem in Imotongi State because of the frequent robberies and lootings along the state's roads, making it extremely risky for farmers to take their produce to market. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Torit.
The Olympic Games officially open Friday in Rio de Janeiro, where the theme is Live Your Passion. However, much of the attention has not focused on the athletes, but on health concerns. The threat from Zika virus has topped the list, but pollution also poses risk. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Athletes train long and hard to compete in the Olympics. They know who their toughest competitors are and what it will take to win a medal. What they don't know is how much of a health risk they face in the Brazilian city. It's usually not something to worry about at the modern games. Among those monitoring conditions in Rio is Dr. Stephen Gluckman. He's a professor of infectious diseases and medical director at Penn Global Medicine, part of the University of Pennsylvania health system. He says Zika, like other diseases, has raised fear among many people.
There have been certainly other epidemic diseases that have generated an incredible amount of angst, even going back to our region, Legionnaire's disease in the 70s, and then HIV, obviously, generated angst well beyond the medical implications in terms of contagiousness early on. Oh, Ebola, too, I think, got a lot of people's attention for fear what it represented for spreading beyond where it was.
What's unique about Zika, he says, is that it's become part of the Olympic story this year. People are traveling to where the disease is.
More often than not, people are trying to go the other way.
So how dangerous is Zika? Dr. Gluckman says
about 80% of people have no symptoms at all, and then the people that get symptoms, the symptoms themselves are really expected to be quite mild. It's a relatively unpleasant 5 to 7 day illness, but nothing of significance.
However, one of the possible complications from Zika infection is Guillain-Barré syndrome. It attacks the nervous system and can cause partial paralysis. But Gluckman says that's not the complication that has caused the most fear.
What makes this a particularly volatile problem is this pregnancy connection. When women are pregnant, they're anxious about outcomes, always. It's just normal. Well, the husbands are too.
Microcephaly can cause abnormally small heads in infants, but Zika can lead to many other physical and developmental problems. But while this may happen to a relatively small number of babies, its impact has been huge. He says what's been lost in the controversy over Zika has been possible infection by other diseases carried by the same Aedes aegypti mosquito, namely chikungunya and dengue.
Chikungunya is a much bigger risk overall than Zika, and it spread like wildfire in the Caribbean, but most of my patients have never heard of it. It's because of the lack of this pregnancy association. Several million people that have gotten chikungunya in the Caribbean. It's amazing how few people have heard of it. Dengue is also throughout there. It's much less common, but it's potentially to be the most severe of all of the diseases. People can die of dengue. You wouldn't die of chikungunya, and certainly you don't die of Zika.
Dr. Gluckman says individuals in Rio and elsewhere can do a lot to prevent a mosquito bite, which in the case of the Aedes aegypti happens during the day.
People should be applying a good insect repellent. That would be either 25 to 30% DEET. DEET's the active ingredient in a number of them, or 20% picardin. That's the other active chemical. In addition, long sleeves and long pants. One can spray one's clothes with an insecticide called permethrin. That's sort of almost like magic. You spray it on, and it lasts multiple weeks through multiple washings.
But the infectious disease expert says the biggest health risk in Rio comes from pollution, raw sewage. Human waste from millions of Rio's residents flows directly into the waters off the city's beautiful beaches, and lots of athletes will be swimming in or sailing or rowing on that water.
Stay out of the water. I mean, you got to be nuts. And I wasn't kidding. It's a way bigger potential health risk than Zika, although it won't lead to fetal malformations. But you're much more likely to get sick from the water than you are from a mosquito bite down there.
According to tests conducted by the Associated Press, athletes who swallow just 3 teaspoons of polluted water are almost certain to be infected with viruses. These can and have caused intestinal and breathing problems.
Apparently, this water is particularly loaded with a virus called adenovirus. But you can get E. coli infections, you can get typhoid fever. Anything that people have in their feces can get into the water there.
Depending on what germs a person swallows, it can take anywhere from 3 days to 2 weeks to show symptoms. Dehydration is one of the major problems these bacteria and viruses can cause. Dr. Gluckman says being in great shape, as Olympic athletes are, will not protect them from mosquito bites or swallowing sewage. But Rio faces other problems too, including terrorist threats, gang violence, and debt. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
From Brazil, we move to Cameroon, where a recent government study has revealed that as many as 70% of babies are not exclusively breastfed during their first 6 months of life. Mothers feed newborn on maize porridge or other forms of milk, which can seriously endanger their health. The government is trying to get the message out, as Muki Edward Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Nineteen-year-old Liliane Getche dishes up a local maize porridge called pap for her two-month-old baby. She says she breastfed the child just for a month and a half. She says she has had only one child and does not want her breast to lose its shape because she is still very young. She says at her age, she does not want to look like old mothers whose breasts have become flabby. Across town in the capital, three-month-old Henrietta Ngufo cries at the Misasi District Hospital. Her mother, 26-year-old Comfort Ngufo, says she started losing weight when she stopped breastfeeding her a week ago.
Prefer artificial milk. It saves me time. There are some very nice milks in the market I can get for your child. It's just all about quality.
Dr. Evelyn Ma at the Pediatric Hospital in Yaoundé works to debunk myths.
Whether you breastfeed the baby or you don't breastfeed your baby, you age, and with age your breast will become flabby. Breast milk contains all what the baby needs. When they breastfeed their baby exclusively, what they have to do is eat balanced meals and drink a lot of water.
Pediatrician Dr. Dorian Vogo of the Family Welfare Department of Cameroon's Health Ministry told VOA a quarter of infants who die in Cameroon have been denied exclusive breast milk during the first 6 months of their lives. The World Health Organization has also noted a correlation. The WHO says more than 800,000 lives would be saved globally if all babies were fed nothing but mother's milk until 6 months of age.
Actuellement, l'allaitement maternel, on va le dire, souffre de cette...
Dr. Mvogo says women shouldn't believe local myths like that having sexual relations will contaminate their milk and make their babies sick. There is no relation between the two, the doctor said. She says some women also tell her they think that breast milk can go bad in a woman's body, something else the doctor says is simply not true. Dr. Mvogo says Cameroon should take a lesson from Kenya, which she says has boosted breastfeeding and infant health by regulating how formula is marketed and requiring safety notices on the packaging. She says human breast milk contains natural antibodies that protect babies against infection, and formula milk does not. Cameroon gives a period of 2 months for working mothers to remain at home and breastfeed their newborns. After the 2 months, the law requires they be given 2 hours each working day for a period of 4 months to go home and breastfeed their babies. Some family welfare advocates are calling for the state-protected maternity leave to be extended to 6 months, though there is concern that this would only benefit mothers working in higher-income jobs. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
That information from Moki Edwin Kinzeka brings us to the end of our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Pretty Girl by the Rhymers. We have been listening to Rhymers with the song Pretty Girl. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We are happy you could be here with us. We hope to see you tomorrow evening for another show of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.